Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
From KERA in North Texas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Actor Bryan Cranston has played some unforgettable characters.
George, you know Tim Watley.
Yeah, dentist of the stars.
What's up?
I'll tell you what's up. I'm a Jew.
Excuse me?
I'm a Jew. I finished converting 2 days ago.
Oh, well. Welcome aboard.
I'm not an idiot, Lois. Now, please, will you hand me my screen box?
I'll write you a movie for $1,200, then.
And you don't want your name on it?
No, you don't want my name on it.
And I expect to see your bright and shiny faces wearing your big all the way with LBJ hats tonight when I take the stage.
I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No, I am the one who knocks.
Decades before Cranston played Walter White or LBJ, he was proud simply to achieve what his father never could, earning his living as a working actor. Cranston writes about his early life, his search for the emotional core of the characters he takes on, and how fame in his 50s changed him in his new memoir, A Life in Parts. I talked with him about it yesterday. Bryan Cranston, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Good to be here.
So your parents were both aspiring actors at one time, but it was your father who wanted to be a star.
Yeah, and I guess that's what most people go to Hollywood or New York to do. They intend to be a star. But it really put him in a tailspin. And, you know, of course, I was too young at the time to know it. But in retrospect, when I look back and I see his life and his trajectory and his ambition, I think he got caught up in the ego of it, and it really brought him to his knees. I mean, emotionally and ego wise, and it took its toll on our family. So up until I was 10, 11 years old, we had a very nice childhood, a very cohesive family with my older brother, and my younger sister was 7 years younger than me. And my dad and my mom were very vivacious and alive and attentive parents, both members of the PTA. And my mom was the den mom. And, you know, my dad coached us in Little League. And my mom made our own Halloween costumes. I mean, it was really a good thing. And I think that's why it put me in such a tailspin when he left, about when I was 11 or 12. But certainly by when I was 12, but it started earlier and start weaning himself off the family until he was gone. And it just shocked us. And I started my storytelling early by weaving these lies to my neighbor friends about my dad coming home at night and playing with us. You guys are sleeping, so you know, just to protect my own emotions, which I couldn't reconcile. I didn't know how to deal with that. And my mother, my poor mother, was heartbroken. It was the love of her life. And she wasn't mature enough to really handle it and to realize that she's got to weather the storm and move on. So she started to self-medicate and became an alcoholic. And so not only did I have to deal with the detachment from my father physically, my mother emotionally, it was I'm on my own, kind of 12. My brother, 14 at the time, was really my guiding light, really helping me get through some tough times. It really wasn't fair to him. He was just a boy as well.
You write about not really being able to express a lot of strong emotions, and it makes sense. When everything else is in chaos, you have this sense that you need to keep it together. It's interesting that as an actor, you've been able to access that, because it seems like a lot of people would learn to cauterize those emotions and not be able to reach them again.
It's really interesting. I mean, when I go through therapy and talk about that, and the therapist is saying, yeah, you're really channeling your emotional journey through your work. And I found an avenue where I'm not only – it's an accepted place to put it, but a rewarding place to put it. So I'm being encouraged to place it there. And it is cathartic to a great degree to be able to take on a character and be able to use a lot of the darker idiosyncrasies of my own character to put and infuse those characters with and allow them to have those feelings. As my therapist was saying, it's okay. Whatever methods any child uses to navigate through a tough childhood, it's okay. It really is, to survive. That's good. But once you become an adult and once you're past that, you need to reorganize the way you operate. Otherwise, that same method will turn around and cannibalize you. You cannot use the same things that you did as a child to get through it. So it's been a journey for me. But yeah, I have been able to have an outlet for those emotions, you know, and feelings of anger and resentment and detachment and aloneness and guilt. You know, imagine there's all of those things at play.
You write very convincingly here about the hard work that it takes to be an actor and the years of preparation and the preparation you do even before you show up on set somewhere. But you also talk about having been a kid who was always looking for the shortcut. And I wonder how you reconcile those two things.
I grew up. That was my way. And that was the method of operation for Brian as a teenager, learning the shortcut. Because I wasn't mature enough and I didn't have a clear path ahead of me, I had no parental guidance to be able to say, no, you have to do it this way. You have to go in this order. So I just had to choose my own order. And in many cases, like any child, really, they'll choose the path of least resistance, the easy way, the one where I can circumvent responsibility or accountability. And my own family dubbed me Sneaky Pete because I did have a sort of a duplicitous nature to look for ways that I can avoid the work. In retrospect, I got to a point in my 20s when I was starting my work as an actor and I realized, so had I just put all that energy and time and effort that I was putting toward avoiding responsibility, had I just put that toward the work, I would have gained a lot more. So I just adjusted the work ethic and the energy I put into avoiding it into doing it. And that's where I found my path and results in as far as how it made me feel, not only in my working life, but in my personal life, trying to set a foundation that is sound and I could build on.
You talk about the value of arrogance for an actor, not moving through the world, but when you're there to do the work. Can you explain that?
There's a brilliant actor named Shirley Knight who was nominated for Oscars, Sweet Bird of Youth and others, and really a wonderful actor. And I took her class. She was teaching class, and I took her class for a while. And she said actors have to have an actor's arrogance, and that's not to be construed as an arrogant nature outside of the work, but you have to be the type of person who wants the ball with 3 seconds left. You know, I want to take the risk. I want to be in there, sink or swim, when the final buzzer goes off, you know. And I think that's true. And you have to have that kind of confidence, because the word arrogance has obviously a negative tone to it. I think it's more of having a confidence to present yourself to say, I'm confident in what I'm doing. Here's what I'm doing. Here's this character I created, and I think it may solve your problem. Here it is. And then I just walk away and allow them to either accept that or reject it. It's up to them. It's their decision. But as far as my work is concerned and how I learn to adjust year after year being an actor is to just focus on what my job is and not someone else's job. And I was, once I glommed onto that, I was a much happier person. And I wasn't resentful to anyone else getting a job because it wasn't about competition with someone else or anything like that. It was about just living and doing my work and presenting it and setting a high standard for myself and trying to live up to it.
You write here about the difference between auditioning to get a job and auditioning to do a job and what a shift that was for you.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was about 25 years ago. I used to think that an audition was a job interview. And it makes sense because a television show or a movie is hiring actors, and that's why you're there to audition. So it's that mindset could be firmly planted. But when you are trying to get something from someone, or you need something or want something from someone else, you're giving up your control and your power, as opposed to thinking of it as if you're presenting a present to someone. When we do charity work, when we give a present to a friend that we feel is really going to need or like or love this present, we are empowered by that. We feel great doing that. And that's where the delicacy of that. You want to keep that inside. It's not something that I'm giving you a present. My talent is so rich that here's my present to you. It's not that. It's a quiet confidence that you say, I value the work I've done on creating this character, and I want to give it to you. And it's up to you now to do whatever you feel you want with it, either have me continue or not. And I'm okay either way. And you walk away confident. And the other side benefit I found with that is that I no longer felt a sense of competition with someone. So that if a friend or a colleague got a job that I auditioned for, I was purely and truly happy for them. Boy, that cleansed me. You know, I did from mind and body. I was no longer, I was not holding any resentment. I was actually happy for them because I didn't have an attachment to an outcome when I'm doing my work. It was like, here it is. It's complete in and of itself, and I leave it for you, like a true present. When you give someone a sweater, you don't then go, you're not wearing my sweater. What? Why aren't you wearing my sweater?
Right.
You have to give it freely, and you can't do this also fake. You can't do it expecting something in return. Okay, Chris, I gave you a present. Do you have something for me?
Right. Where's my scarf?
It doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. You have to give it freely. And when you do, it's an empowering feeling.
How much can anybody teach an actor, and how much do you just have to learn by doing it?
You do have to learn by doing it. And you can. You can guide. You can guide talented people who have innate talent. It can be enriched. But you can't teach someone to be a good actor if they don't have talent. But you can nurture it or discover it and maybe help them unlock some of the blockades they've put in front of themselves, or that society has, or lack of opportunity has, or something like that. And I talk to young actors all the time, and I say, you know, you should only attempt this as a career if you are in love with the feeling of acting, if it empowers you as a human being. Then you need to try, because the only failure then is if you don't try, then that's truly a failure. It's better to try something and go, wow, I'm really not good at that.
Right.
You know, for my book, I did the audio commentary, the audiobook, and this is the second time I've done that, and it will be the last time I do it. Because I found that I really wasn't that good at doing that. And there's people far, far better than me. And I didn't find the joy in doing the audio portion of the book as much as I did writing it. I think I was judging myself too much. I think I was listening to my words and going, no, I got to do it over because I didn't like the way I said the word, you know. So I need to get out of my own way there.
The book is called A Life in Parts. My guest is actor Bryan Cranston. We'll be back after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open, with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest today is actor Bryan Cranston. His new memoir is called A Life in Parts. You started in TV in the early 80s, and thanks to the miracle of Netflix, my husband and I had a Bryan Cranston marathon last night, and we saw, like, A Murder, She Wrote.
Oh,
and
I'm so sorry.
You were in a Chips and Touched by an Angel and Matlock. I mean, there was a lot of bad TV
back then. You must have been in pain last night. I'm so sorry.
It was actually really fun, but what has changed? Because TV now is really good.
Yeah. I think audiences are far more sophisticated now. Our younger generations, my daughter's generation, she's 23, far more sophisticated. And by virtue of that, the demand for more subtle or nuanced storytelling is there. And they just won't stand for anything that is not perfect. And I think that was helped, obviously, by the explosion of technology, that the choices are far greater. To give you an example, when I was first starting out, I was 25 years old. I got a job on a soap opera in New York, Loving for ABC. We were the lowest rated soap on the air. There were 16 soap operas on the air at that time. We were the lowest rated. Our ratings varied from 8.9 million to 9.6 million people watching every day.
Wow.
That's unheard of now. Not even the top shows. If we had that, we'd be in the top 10 of shows on the air, primetime and daytime. So now with the explosion of the internet and you know Netflix, and there's so many opportunities for people not to watch, that everyone got that message. We need to do something that is extraordinary, compelling storytelling. And if it's not compelling storytelling, we're not interested. The high tide raises all boats. And that's what we found with Breaking Bad, is that this was extraordinary storytelling written by a master in Vince Gilligan. And he did an amazing job.
You first worked with Vince Gilligan when he had written an episode of The X-Files. So your character kidnaps Agent Mulder and forces him to drive west.
Why are you doing this?
Why am I doing what?
This.
It's not in your best interest to make me question that right now.
How do I know you ain't doing exactly what they want you to? Driving me all around creation, experimenting on me. How do I know it ain't that?
I guess you don't.
I ain't saying you are. I'm just saying there's no way to treat a man. Take away his dignity like that. It ain't right.
What qualities was he looking for in an actor in that episode?
That was my first introduction to him. That was in 1998, actually. And it was just a job for me. I was glad to have it. And I would play this despicable character. Now, to give you an idea, we're just talking about the awful shows of that era. And along comes the show X-Files with a cadre of really talented writers. And normally, they would have cast that character and written that character as a sympathetic person. The storyline briefly was that this character had some kind of bug in his ear, and if he didn't move in a westerly direction at 80 miles an hour, his head would explode, which is an awful thing to happen. Now, what they would normally do is write that character as sympathetic and then have the audience go, oh yeah, he's a nice man. Come on, David Duchovny, save him. And if he did save me, yay, good for you. And if he didn't save me, well, at least he tried. And not be connected, not be passionate about it, not be invested in the story or the character, just a casual observer. But what Vince Gilligan did in that show is he made this character despicable, a horrible, nasty, ugly human being. He was anti-Semite. He was an anti-Semite. He was prejudicial about everybody. And why? Why would you do that? Because he knew that it was important to place the moral dilemma in the heart of his central character. To David Duchovny's character, Mulder, the question was, do I save this man simply because he's a human being? Now that's rich. So the audience is debating themselves. They're ambivalent about what they should do. And when he dies, when my character dies, sorry about the spoiler alert, people should go, I know he's a horrible person, but I kind of felt a little sorry for him too, because he was a lost human being. And that was the nuance and the genius, really, of Vince Gilligan, the man who then created Breaking Bad.
And years later, Vince Gilligan fought for you to play Walter White over Matthew Broderick.
Well, I know Matthew was one of the names on the list, and Steve Zahn, and I'm not sure who else was on it. But I've firmly adapted this philosophy of I'm not in competition with other people. I'm just here to do my job, and whatever happens, happens. But yes, he was my champion to get the role because of that experience with him on The X-Files. And people did have sympathy for that character, you know, despite his actions and his horrible words. And I think he felt that that was the alchemy that this character, Walter White, needed to have. Despite what he's about to go through and do, people still needed to sympathize with him. And that made for a richer experience, not just for the audience, but for me.
What's interesting about you being cast to play Walter White, people know you now as this character, right? And they've seen you play LBJ, and they've seen you take on these really dramatic roles. But you had made a name for yourself in comedy. What did you learn, first of all, playing Jerry Seinfeld's dentist, Tim Watley?
Doing Seinfeld was like going to comedy boot camp to witness firsthand Jerry Seinfeld's genius and Larry David's genius and the brilliant comics of Jason Alexander and Julia Dreyfus and Michael Richards. And then the phenomenal writing staff that they had to be able to create four different agendas and interweave those throughout the course of them. I mean, it's just brilliant writing. So I was, you know, cast as the dentist, Tim Watley, glad to be there. And every time I was on the show, I only did six episodes. I thought it's probably the last time I'm going to be on the show. And they kept finding different reasons for this character to come back, but only to serve the storyline of the main characters. So there was one time when I was when Jerry thought I was molesting him in his dental chair, and we rehearsed the scene. I gave Jerry laughing gas, and then I said "Sweet dreams," and and I lower his chair. When they left, I stayed on the set, and I was handling the equipment and thinking about, you know, where all the things is, because I wanted to get accustomed to that. It's supposed to be my office, so I wanted to be aware of where things were and how it felt. And I heard a voice, "Hey, you know, it would be funny." And I looked around. I looked up on a ladder was an electrician who was adjusting a light. And I said, "Are you talking to me?" And he said, "Yeah, it would be funny." "What?" I said. He said, "If you get the laughing gas and you take a hit off it yourself first before you gave it to Jerry." I thought, you know, that is funny. So I waited until we were shooting, and I said,
"Cheryl, would you ready the nitrous oxide, please?"
And she hands it to me, and I... "That's good." And then I put it on. Well, Jerry falls over laughing, and Larry David is laughing, and he doesn't laugh. Larry David observes laughter and can identify funny things or things that have potential to humor. But he'll say, don't, Jerry, don't laugh. Jerry, don't laugh. No. Okay, wait 2 seconds before you come in the door. Now it's funny. Here, that's good. That's funny. Okay, go. You know, he sounds like Bernie Sanders. That's why.
So, I've heard that.
I heard that, yeah. And they're saying, "Wow, that's a funny idea." And I said, I looked around. There's no more ladder. And I looked around and I saw the guy and said, "He gave it to me." And everybody's head turned to this guy, one of the member of the crew. And he just shrugged his shoulders. And I go, "Yeah." Which made me realize it doesn't matter where a great idea comes from. It be open to it.
When you were cast as Hal on Malcolm in the Middle, there wasn't much on the page initially. How did you build a character for yourself out of what wasn't written yet?
That was a little surprising to me. For the audition, I didn't know what to do because it was very thin. And Linwood Boomer, the creator of the show, even told me so. He goes, we'll fill it out, but for right now, for this pilot episode, we're just going to have to find our way through it. And for myself, though, I needed to have something to hold on to for a character. Otherwise, I'm just floating out there. So I was kind of lost because I really didn't understand who he was or where he was going. So I simply looked at the most flashy character, the one that was, you know, filled with as much bombast as you can have. And it was Lois, the wife character, and she was fearless and aggressive and tough and, you know, serious and all these things. And so I start writing down all these attributes to the Lois character. And just on a lark, I started to think, what are the opposite characteristics to her? And I started writing down afraid of everything, fearful, soft, sweet, romantic, unsure. You know, and I realized as I'm looking at those words, oh, I'm creating Hal. I'm creating a character. If I just use those characteristics as a nice counterbalance to the lead character, her character, then I will compliment her like a good marriage. And so that's what I did.
Ow!
Boys, quit horsing around and eat your dinner.
Hey! Stop! Now we are at zero tolerance now. Do you hear me? Zero tolerance. You boys have got to learn to behave.
From now on.
Who wants more mac and cheese?
All right.
Yeah.
That is it. Sit down. Just because your mother isn't here is no excuse to misbehave. Now, when I say zero tolerance, I mean zero tolerance. Tolerance to the zero degree. I'm talking zip, nada, zilch. In terms of tolerance.
One of Hal's hallmarks was that he was easily excitable in certain situations. Was there ever a time where you thought this is over the top, or was it just liberating that you didn't have to worry about that?
You know, as actors, we don't. In fact, for me, I often say in everything I do, there's a definitive trust that you have to have with your director. And in that case, it was Linwood Boomer, our creator and head writer. And he would pull me back wherever it was. But it's much better to go too far and being able to pull back as opposed to not going far enough and maybe not ever getting to that distance of where it could go. So I have a phrase that I use, and I used it for Trumbo, the movie I did, and All the Way, which were both directed by Jay Roach, who was a brilliantly talented man and a sweet man. And I said, Jay, as you know now, I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to go farther than the character should live in. And you pull me back because I'm going to keep going to see how far. Maybe there's a moment that I can reach way out there. So I'm going out on this limb. When you start to hear it crack, pull me back towards the trunk. And that's probably the sweet spot of where we need to live with that character.
This is the most important election of your lifetime. And the choices couldn't be clearer. Peace or war, brotherhood or division, prosperity or poverty, a march into a bright future or a retreat into a dark past. It is all or nothing. And every single one of you needs to go out there and fight for every single vote in every single part of this great country of ours. God bless you.
What is it like as an actor to do something that is either very emotional or it's just funny, but it's taken all of your energy, and to get it perfect and then know that you might have to do it again and again and again?
Well, that's the stamina part of being an actor, a film actor. The stamina part of being a stage actor, and I hate to draw that kind of comparison, but it's a different energy that you need to present. On film, you have to be able to know when to shut down. When they're changing directions and they're going to not need you for the next half hour, I would go to my trailer and lie down often if there was an emotional scene, or just calm down, Be alone. Don't speak. Don't activate your mind with other things. Just calm down so that you retain energy. And the older I get now, it's now a necessity. And then come back and be able to hit it and punch it in the face as hard as you can each and every time, whether you're on screen or off screen for other actors. That's the way I was taught, and that's the way I will continue to do it until I go, I'm just too tired now. I can't do it anymore. And with stage work, when I was doing All the Way on Broadway, it wasn't so much the doing the play, a three-hour play from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. You had to be at the peak of your energy. So I had to adjust my whole lifestyle to be able to make that the peak time, which meant when at 11 o'clock I'm vibrating and pumping with adrenaline, and it took me 3-4 hours before I can come down off that and go to sleep. And that doesn't guarantee that you're going to wake up then at noon, which you hope to, but no. So you're tired the next day. That you can't cancel the show. Maybe I can take a nap. I need to eat something. Can I be digested by then? So you're constantly filled with those thoughts of how do I prepare myself for the next round? And then you have to be ready at 8 o'clock again. And it doesn't matter if you're sick or tired. You've got to give it your all each and every time. And then that's what starts to wear on you. So come Monday, your only day off, it's all recovery. You're almost in a fog. You're so exhausted. And in order to retain energy when I was on Broadway, I didn't speak on Mondays. I didn't have any conversations at all. I would have a little notepad and I would go into a restaurant and write down what's the soup or whatever. And that helped me considerably.
My guest is actor Bryan Cranston. His new memoir is called A Life in Parts. We'll be back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
All the things that I did, you need to understand.
I have to hear one more time that you did this for the family.
I did it for me. I liked it. I was good at it. And I was really... alive.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with actor Bryan Cranston, who you just heard with Anna Gunn in a scene from Breaking Bad. How did you find Walter White and what drove him?
I always look for the emotional core in a character. And that's not a highfalutin kind of comment. To feel comfortable and confident in playing any character, I feel like I need to hold on to something emotionally, intellectually. And so I feel like if I can find their emotional core, what governs them as a person, then that is a great foundation for that. And I couldn't find it in Walter White. For Hal and Malcolm in the Middle, it was fear. He was afraid of everything. And so that lent itself to a lot of opportunities for comedy as well as some pathos and interesting moments. With Walter White, I couldn't find it. I didn't know what his emotional core was until I started realizing he was depressed. and he missed opportunities in his life, and he's gone to seed, and he's reeling back, and he's just kind of putting one foot in front of the other now. So I started thinking about depression and that, and it led me to where I needed to go. And basically, from what I was reading about depression, it's not completely fair to do this, and psychologists might roll their eyes, but to me, from a layman's point of view, this helped me, that there are two basic umbrella ways to manifest depression. One is outwardly, where you blame everyone else for your misgivings or failures or whatever in life. My ex-wife, my boss, my friend screwed me over, this and that and the other. Or you implode, you go inward and you become invisible. You waste away, you become, you don't have an identity anymore. And that's what happened to Walter White. His missed opportunities caved him in, and he became invisible to himself and to society. And by accepting that, and that really indicated to me, and I went, oh, that's why I can't find his emotional core. It's calloused over. I can't find it because he doesn't even know how he feels. It's so calloused over year after year after year of covering. And then what happens is that, like a volcano, it explodes. And that explained a lot to me. So this measured man became emotional and impulsive and egotistical and self-centered and wanted to intimidate people. And he all this was because of this explosion in his being once he made this fateful decision to cook crystal meth and become a drug kingpin. Started out with altruistic notions about doing it for his family. But as we just heard, he found it was really about him. It fed him. It made him feel important and big, even for a small, a short period of time.
You write that early in your career, early in your training as an actor, you wondered if there would ever be a time when you would feel something real, not just do a simulacrum of an emotion on stage or on film. This had to have been just an incredibly emotionally taxing role to play.
It was exhausting. It really was, because, you either physically pushing yourself in the heat of the desert or the freezing cold of the high deserts, when it drops down to single digits and you're out there and the wind is whipping and sand is getting in your eyes, and you have to ignore that. I mean, those are the things that everyone deals with if you work outdoors, which, half of the time I do work outdoors. But I never forgot the joy and the gift that I've been given to be entrusted with the idea of telling stories for a living. And that's what I do. And I will never, ever take that for granted. It's something that was a desire of mine, a goal of mine. And I went after it, and it happened for me. And I will be eternally grateful, not just to the champions along the way who supported me, but just that was my biggest professional achievement and most proud of, is that at age of 25, that's what I did for a living. I was a professional actor, and for the rest of my adult life, that's all I had to do. But playing Walter White, you still have those emotional and physical challenges. And at the end of a day, I would go into the makeup and hair trailer, and I would take a very hot, moist towel, and I would wrap it around my bald head like a turban almost. And then I would wrap another one around my neck and my face, almost like you're getting a professional shave.
Right.
And I would just sit there in a chair and allow the moisture and the heat to just pull out the toxins and the grime of the day, emotionally and physically. And it just all lifted, and I would wash it away and put some moisturizer on and take off Walter White's clothes and put my own on, and I left him at the studio. I didn't want to take that guy home. I left him there. And the next day, when I slipped into those wallabies and put on his glasses and looked at myself in the mirror, and if it was Heisenberg, I'd put on that hat, and I go, there you are.
Did your relationship to the character change as he progressively got worse and worse? I can't think of any other really narrative arc in American television where really the character just progressively gets worse.
There wasn't any. when Vince Gilligan told me what he wanted to do, I realized that taking Walter White from a good person to a bad person was unique, because television to that point is really all about stasis. Characters that you depend on to react a certain way because you know who they are. And this changed everything. Even Tony Soprano was Tony Soprano from the beginning to the end. Archie Bunker, Thomas Mackey, Ross and Rachel, whoever you identify with, they were who they were, except Walter White. He changed, and he was becoming a different person. But no, my relationship to him was from the inside out. So as other people, as everyone else was looking at Walter White, I was looking out through Walter White's eyes. So I never judged him. Hmm. When I'm Brian looking at a script and I realize, oh, I have to poison a little boy. Okay. Then all of a sudden the intellect of Walter White clicks in and I go, all right, I have to be very careful how I do this. I gauge his weight and make sure that I don't give him too much. And I'm in it. I'm just looking. If I took the time to judge him, then by definition, I'm observing and I'm no longer subjective to that character. I only allowed myself to be subjective and live in that body and mind and not go to an objective viewpoint and go, boy, that's pretty awful what he's doing. Because then it could be hard to get back in. And you just have to justify and think of everything that you're doing is for the greater good.
You write with great respect for your colleagues who wrote and directed and shot and acted in Breaking Bad, but you also share some arguments that you had that you felt like were worth having in service to the story, often at the point that the actors had taken the written material and were trying to make a story out of it, including the scene where Walt kills Mike.
Yeah. In writing this book, I didn't want to just write, and then this was great, and that happened, and then this was great, and then this was great. I wanted to write truthfully, and not just from my work life, but from my challenging childhood and how that turned around for me, and now I have a great marriage and a nice personal foundation that allows me to go crazy in my work, because my home life is sane, and I try to teach that to young kids. It's like, get your house in order. How much do you want to be an actor and to be able to have an engaged journey in your work life? Well, to do that, you need to have a nice, strong foundation. And then in doing the work with this, I had some, objections, probably four. I can count them on one hand in the 6 years that we had. And I talk about it in the book. And this one where I kill Mike was interesting, because I had a disagreement with the writer director on that episode. And the great thing about our disagreement is that he was not wrong, but then neither am I. It's all subjective. It's how we feel about it. And ultimately it comes down to, we've got to get it done. I did it a certain way. I think the way it came out, as far as the final scene when Mike dies, and I say to myself, or to Mike, whom, if he's listening,
I just realized that Lydia has a name that I can get him from her. I'm sorry, Mike.
Which is to say, he didn't have to die. And I thought, what? That just makes Walter White look like a jackass. I mean, a really horrible, horrible person, an unforgivable act, as opposed to, I was arguing that the act itself of impulsively killing Mike was enough, that the allegiance to Walter at that point would shift again to Aaron Paul's character of Jesse Pinkman, which was the intention. They wanted the allegiance to shift to Jesse at that moment. And the writers felt that I had to say that comment in order for the allegiance, for people to go, oh, I hate this guy. as opposed to, I think it would have been stronger. I still do. I think it would have been stronger had I just realized in my action, when the camera looks at me and realize, oh, Walt knows he made a mistake. He messed up big time. I don't know how he gets out of this, and he's become this animal now. I think it would have done the same thing. But again, that's the joy of this art form, of any art form. It's so subjective.
You didn't become really famous until you were fully an adult. You had your head on straight, which may not be what, you know, young actors are hoping for. But it sounds like being famous, and you're not complaining here, I want to be clear, but it sounds like it can be awful.
I can't say it's awful. It's an element of my life now that I have to learn how to navigate. And I say that earnestly. I still haven't learned how to completely behave. My life has become so social that I meet thousands of people. I'm out promoting a book or promoting a movie or something, and that's part of the business, and I'm recognized everywhere now. And I love to talk to fans. It's not that. I'm glad that they were affected by the work. But just the sense of privacy or pure energy, saving energy. I used to reject the notion of stardom because my goal was just to be a working actor. I just want to make my living as an actor. And like I said, that's my proudest achievement professionally to date. And then this explosion happened, and it's like, wow, it's been great. I have tremendous opportunity now. I'm getting to work with great writers and directors and actors, and it's a really wonderful in that sense. Along with that comes a lack of privacy, you're in the public eye. So what happens is that I tend to stay indoors more often. When I go to a hotel room, I do a lot of room service. Just because I need to be quiet. Even receiving praise, it's an interesting thing that I discovered, takes energy to say thank you.
To be gracious.
To be gracious, to say thank you, to sign an autograph, to take a picture, and everybody has a phone and everybody wants a picture. And it takes energy to do that. And if one person sees it, then it's okay for others and you can't then say no. So you have to kind of set up a little boundaries when you go in public. Like when I go into a restaurant, and if I'm sitting at a table, I won't sign or take pictures with anybody because I want to try to, especially when I'm with my wife or daughter, I want to try to create our time, and I don't want that to break that, you know. So it's just little things that you find along the way that you have to structure for your own well-being. I hope I learned it. But I can't complain. There's nothing to complain. I'm the luckiest guy in the world.
Brian Cranston, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Chris.
Actor Brian Cranston won multiple Emmy Awards for playing Walter White in Breaking Bad and a Tony for the play All the Way. His new memoir is called A Life in Parts. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Alan Roberts. Samantha Guzman is associate producer and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.